Hello, I'm Marty Kirilovich, and welcome to another episode of The Science in the Fiction. In our last episode, Holly and I talked to science fiction author and futurist Carl Schrader about artificial intelligence and virtual reality in his most recent book, Stealing Worlds. And this episode is our usual scientific follow-up with an expert in each of these fields. As it happens, I have two old friends who have PhDs and a career's worth of experience and expertise in both artificial intelligence and virtual reality, and they're married to each other. So they were kind enough to read Stealing Worlds and have an extensive conversation with me about the book. In this interview, they bring their professional and personal perspectives on Carl Schroeder's book and also give us a view of where AI and VR were 20 years ago, where they are today, and what they might become in the future. So, without further ado, here are Dr. Peter Gorniak on artificial intelligence and Dr. Sidney Nielsen on virtual reality in Stealing Worlds. So Peter and Sydney are good friends of mine. We did our undergrads together. We were associated through a program called Science One at UBC in 1995. Well, I was, and Sydney was. Peter was 2 years older than us. He did the program in 93. So we all became friends for the next, 4 or 5 years of our undergrads and then throughout the rest of our lives. I was at Peter and Sydney's wedding. I gave a memorable speech, I gather, which I would love to hear again one day.
You did.
Yeah, I was the announcer who pumped the floor with a staff and announced when people came in and their names, as befits the royal occasion that it was. Anyway, so that's how we know each other. And I want to hear from you guys then. Peter, what's your background and why and what do you know about AI that might be salient to this interview?
Okay. I don't know how much I'll talk about AI today. Well, I guess I will. But So as Marty said, I did my undergrad at UBC in computer science, where, in 1998, I wrote neural networks in C++ for my honors thesis. Now they're all the rage. And they were tiny ones with like three levels.
Wow.
Custom C++ code on a friend's computer.
Yeah. Hold on. Before you go on, aren't you one of the, like, you wrote a Kant emulator? And isn't that basically like a early language model type thing? Yeah.
I did not write a Kant emulator. I fooled you with one, but that wasn't mine. I did write a computational poetry program for one of my artificial intelligence undergrad classes, which was not very sophisticated and does nothing like you would do today.
Cool.
But it was fun. And it was controversial, to be fair. A lot of people attacked me over it, even in the class. So that was fun. Nothing has changed. People still do that in my day job. Then I did a master's in artificial intelligence and machine learning at UBC. Then I went to MIT, to the MIT Media Lab, where I joined a group that studied initially robots that learned language, like children learn language. And this has, strangely become pretty relevant again, I think, in that back then we really hypothesized that the reason that we didn't have AI was that human beings just took a whole bunch of shortcuts and took they had just had all these biases built in, and they were embedded in a world and they learned by doing stuff to the world. And so they learned incredibly quickly because they're like these learning machines that are totally biased to learn human language, for example, right? And so my supervisor for his PhD thesis is sort of build one of the first robots that looked at stuff and listened to mothers talk to the infants, and then we played it back for the robot and showed it objects, right? And it would sort of, out of the noise of language, try to figure out what language is, right? It's, the suggestion being that kids do this. And they clearly do, just perhaps not in the same way. And so I went on with that during my thesis, where I really looked at, how could you learn and how could you represent, especially in my case, sort of common intent. And so my thesis was actually in video games, giving people puzzles that they had to collaboratively solve via speech. They weren't in the same room, and then trying to replace one of them with a computer. And so there were these somewhat complicated puzzles in the game called Neverwinter Nights. So that's what I did my PhD in. I did the postdoc. And then because I love games and I was using games for my thesis and everything, I decided to go into the game industry. I joined what would become Rockstar Games in Boston. Again, an AI, mostly a non-player character AI. And then I joined a company called DeviantArt, who I still work for today. I'm now their head of artificial intelligence. It's a social network for artists. And there, I mean, we've traditionally looked at a lot of recommendation problems. So it's like we have 500 million works of art, which should we show to you today? So that's a big problem. But lately also we're into art generation. We have an art generation platform that sort of tries to be playful and creative and inspire you to do creative stuff. I don't know. Maybe I'll draw the parallels to the book later.
Perfect. Yeah. Yeah. Hold that thought. So Peter has been here for the entire birth and current life of AI.
Exactly.
So Sydney, I expect you to talk in as much detail as Peter did and tell me all about yourself.
All right. Well, let's see. I would say I am I'm trained as a scientist, trained as a biologist. My undergrad at UBC as well was in molecular and sort of microbiology. And I think while I was an undergrad, there was this pretty exciting field of bioinformatics, computational biology that was emerging at the time. You know, the Human Genome Project was wrapping up and genomics was really exploding. Anyway, I went to Boston with Peter after my undergrad, and I worked at what was then the Whitehead Institute, but it became essentially the Broad Institute of, you know, MIT and Harvard. And it was a super exciting place to be. I worked as a data analyst and worked on all sorts of fungal genomics projects. And I think I really kind of fell in love with data analysis and, you know, answering biological questions with large data sets. So I ended up doing a PhD in computational biology at MIT. And, you know, I think through that experience, I got to work with a lot of scientists. I got to work with a lot of big data sets, and I realized there was this huge problem in, you know, visualizing it, like having an intuitive interface to it, particularly for people who maybe, you know, didn't have a lot of computational savvy in terms of how to manipulate it. They, you know, wanted more of a graphical user interface. And so I also was influenced by some people at the MIT Media Lab that was just across the street, and really fell in love with data visualization and how do you take complicated information and enable decision making and present it in an intuitive way. And that's really what I've been doing ever since that time. So we moved back to Vancouver and I worked at the BC Cancer Agency for almost a decade as a postdoc and later a research associate, primarily working in cancer genomics and building visualization interfaces to those data sets. And then my career kind of took a radical leap. I decided I was really interested to go see how, you know, software is made outside of academia and in a large company. And I had an opportunity to join Microsoft and I joined their mixed reality team. So I worked on a product team making some really cool apps for the HoloLens and the HoloLens 2. And, you know, we can talk about some of those examples as we discuss the book, but that was a very cool experience working there as a designer and a data scientist. And today I now sort of work full time as an independent contractor, sort of trying to bring this range of experiences and skills together, continuing to do sort of data visualization.
Amazing. So you have had a front row seat as well to the entire birth of, I guess, what we'd call virtual reality in this book, you know, data and visualizing it and the glasses.
The glasses, yeah.
Yeah, like I said, Peter, you've seen AI since its kind of birth and you've seen VR ever since its birth, Sydney, and it's amazing to have you guys in a room talking about this book. So let me ask, how'd you like the book?
Well, so, I mean, this book is just packed with interesting ideas and you know, did I find it intellectually stimulating? Yes, right. Absolutely. It's a fascinating read. Did it make me think? Yes, absolutely. It's a super interesting read. And I think it'll be a lot of fun to keep talking about some of the content. But I think that that's really what the book is about. It's about these ideas. It's about, you know, setting up these, you know, alternative economic systems and imagining how the world might function. And it's really a fairly detailed explanation of, you know, what could potentially happen, like one reality. And I think that the character development, the narrative, to me, is all secondary to the presentation of these ideas.
Oh, so it's science fiction. Like 90% of all science fiction. So what did you think of some of the ideas? Like good stuff, bad stuff from the VR perspective? How did you react to that?
So, I mean, I guess we could start with the visualization part. I think that's, maybe that's somewhat self-contained. And I think that there's a couple of places in the book where there's these scenes of kind of almost like landscapes of data. And, you know, sometimes it's displayed in the sky. I think there's a particular scene towards the end of the book where Sura is sort of in a forest and she has this experience of essentially like seeing and visualizing the complexity of that ecosystem.
Somehow, yeah, it labels the interrelationships between all these objects, which I don't know how you would do that, but...
Yeah, exactly. I think that fell flat for me personally. I think there's a bit of a misconception that if you could just see all of the data, you would understand it, right? If I could just lay it all out and spatially arrange it, it would make sense to me. And, you know, having tried to communicate complicated data sets for many, many years, I just don't think that's true. I don't think that's how it works. I think there can be a lot of complicated patterns in a data set that are not immediately visually apparent. They're not glanceable. You have to do more work. You have to essentially, you know, summarize and filter and aggregate data in a way that serves your question. You know, what is it that I want to know? Okay, now I can organize the data in a way that makes that decision very easy to see. And that's not going to be in the raw data itself. So I think, you know, the description in the book, I think you might walk away from that being like, wow, that's a lot of information, or, you know, wow, that's complicated. But I feel like the emotional reaction she has to it, and he also sort of references how she interprets a bunch of symbols that she's familiar with from the games and the frames, that she is left with some deeper understanding. And I just, I don't buy that. I don't think that's how a visualization like that would work, at least from an analytical point of view, you know, that you reach some understanding. I think there's a whole nother class of visualizations that are really sort of more experiential. They're more like an art installation. And that I think could evoke a much more emotional reaction, you know, something that's not where you're trying to analyze and interpret specific relationships between everything, but rather just walk away with a emotional reaction. And so I feel like maybe this experience should be more on that side, right? That she somehow is left with an impression, but not so much an analytical.
Well, you makes me think, yeah. You know, that half the work, well, the work of VR is the work of presenting data. You know, like I can imagine that you would have different filters, right? And different ways of visualizing, like all the raw data that's coming to you, and you flip through it and you get, you know, but what you said is basically like, you know, every data set comes with a perspective. You organize and inquire of it differently depending on the question you're asking. And so that's pretty cool. I can imagine there will be a large industry for exactly the work you do, the more, you know, we get VR glasses and stuff.
Well, I love that he includes it in the book, because I think it would be, I could imagine a version of the book where there isn't sort of, data like that, like, you know, connectivity of things and signals on the landscape, that it's purely sort of a 3D content. You know, what does somebody look like and what are they wearing, and what is overlaid on my world, sort of, adding content as opposed to sort of visualizing information that maybe is generated from location. So I think it's awesome that's in there. And it's very interesting to think about, you know, what could that look like? It's fascinating to see, you know, things like Apple Watch and people collecting data about themselves and how that's, you know, represented, and, you know, what would the next form of that be like? But then I guess, so that's sort of the viz, that was my impression of the viz part, which I think is a somewhat, you know, minor component of the book, but the AR VR part certainly plays a huge role. And I think it's because it enables, you know, all of these games and frame worlds to exist, right? You need to have this technology. And I mean, in terms of just, you know, some terminology, like I think, you know, virtual reality and augmented reality and mixed reality. I mean, the whole thing's a mess. I think there's very little consensus on how these words are used and what they mean. I believe in the book he uses mixed reality, and, you know, being a former Microsoft employee, I certainly am familiar with the mixed reality term. That's certainly what Microsoft uses to describe their HoloLens technology. But in my mind, that's this sort of true mixture of virtual, you know, elements and real world elements. And in particular, that the virtual stuff interacts, you know, in a meaningful way with the physical stuff. So if I was to bounce a ball, you know, against the wall of my room, it has awareness of that wall, and it would bounce off that wall, just as if it was a real ball, if that makes sense. So there's sort of proper spatial understanding in a mixed reality setup. And so, you know, I think it's super interesting to think about what happens when that becomes ubiquitous, and is just everywhere. And I believe that probably will happen. It's just a question of hardware and when. But I think it's kind of fascinating to think about that. And
well, let me ask you a basic question though, because I don't actually know what is possible, what is happening. Like when he describes something that you put on the glasses and you turn on this LARP world, right? And you can look at somebody and they'll be dressed with different stuff and there'll be a costume involved. It's kind of like Pokemon Go, except in 3D live and on top of the objects you see. Is that possible? Like, can we even do that? Or maybe can we ever do that? Is that the kind of...
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd have to extrapolate to that scale, you know, like the amount of tracking, the quality of the tracking of everything, of every object, of every person, would just, I think, have to be much, much better than it is right now. Now, if everybody has a headset on, you know, maybe there's technology, you could sort of triangulate, you could like use the fact that there are so many sensors out there to improve some of that stuff. So, you know, certainly in my experience, you know, anchoring and stability of anchoring of virtual to real world and sort of error in that, those are all considerations. And I think we have to just extrapolate that somehow all of these things, all of those problems go away. There's like a perfect mapping between the virtual world and the real world. And also that mapping appears to be dynamic. So there must be some intelligence in these, games. Yeah. In these games and these frames, so that if somebody modifies the real world, that game does the right thing. You know, it seems to somehow dynamically update.
Or if they go into an area that hasn't been covered by the LARP, right?
Yeah.
Like, what happens? It turns off? Like, it never explains this, right? It's like, it seems to be everywhere. So every single one of these games covers the world. Well, no LARP right is going to cover every, you know, square inch of the world with the correct objects mapped onto the correct things. So this must all be somehow fully autonomously mapping itself onto the real world in real time.
Yeah, or like, you know, you have overlaying of worlds. That was certainly
that too,
an idea
yeah.
in the book. And so, you know, okay, do I have two groups of people in different, you know, games or frames now intersecting in the same park? And what happens now? Like,
I think it's very unclear in the book, right? Because like, sometimes they're like in a car and they're seeing stuff seemingly overlaid onto all of the world. But then when they're actually playing, they seem to be in these like abandoned warehouses or something that are unused, which makes sense if, you know, you dedicate a space to this kind of thing. But he's never explicit about that these are somehow regionally confined to certain spaces, right? And if they're not, well, that's a much bigger problem than taking a space and putting a game in it.
Yeah, but I think that kind of challenge of, you know, you maybe you have a whole group of people that's not participating in your world. What do you do with their behavior so that it doesn't look strange in your game? You know, so maybe it's like intelligently overlaid or, yeah.
He doesn't say this, but he could say, wow, this is all solved by AI, which he does in other places, right? Which annoys me greatly. It's like the AI out of the box that solves the rest of it. But you could say, okay, well, this is all solved by AI. And if like two groups enter the same space and totally different, they're, you know, each in their own world, the AI somehow figures out how to mesh them together so that they never notice.
I thought that he made them invisible, basically, right? That like your glasses not only add reality, they are able to subtract from reality.
It seems that way because at some point they have like an intruder or set of intruders in their world,
right,
and they take off their glasses to see them and then, you know, talk about them and then quickly finish the game and move on. Right?
Like, I have safety concerns about this approach. I think you got to be able to see everybody you're running around.
The first surprise you get when you buy your first VR headset is, you know, that you can't see your living room, right? And there's all, you know, kick your cat and stuff all the time, right? And you bounce off of walls. Imagine that worldwide.
It's just like that magnified to the whole world.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that's where the mixed reality part is super important, right? It's like, it's not VR. It's you're not cut off. You're still, this is my interpretation of it. You're still seeing the real world. And then this
overlays.
Is like an
But then how do the people
overlay.
Disappear, right?
So how do people disappear? I don't know. I don't think they could.
No, so they may need to be then like, right? Like, I mean, what would make sense to me is if they then become like monsters or something, some accessory NPC in your world, right? But then they wouldn't act the right way if they're people that are out to get you. I don't know, right? Like, this just seems like a problem.
So before I want to give Peter the floor for a bit here on the AI, but before I do, Sydney, can you give me an example of where this sort of technology is actually at or an application that does work like today? And then maybe even, you know, what you think will happen in the future, if not this level of immersive mixed reality kind of thing. Like, what's an application that works with glasses that exist?
Yeah. Well, probably the easiest one for me to talk about would be the one I worked on, and which is sort of in the public domain. You know, people can purchase it, and that would be, you know, Microsoft's Dynamics 365 Guides. That's what it's called for the HoloLens 2. So this is really a enterprise app, and worked in, you know, fields like manufacturing. And what was so compelling to me about it and about joining that team is that it's not a flashy demo. It really works. And so one of the applications is essentially to create work instructions. And then you can put on your HoloLens and you will see these work instructions essentially as like a 2D panel that's in your virtual space. But then you can also add like 3D models. So you can add a model of, you know, the engine that you're trying to work on. And you can then author this, sort of place it in the world. You can annotate it, you know, with arrows. You can add sort of animated components. And then once you finish creating your guide as an author, you can then use this in an operate mode. So you can give it to somebody to operate. And so they essentially are guided through step by step how to perform some set of tasks, you know, how to perform a particular maintenance task on this engine.
Heart surgery?
Right. I mean, you know, certainly medical training. I mean, and actually there was many success stories during the pandemic, as you can imagine, people in their living rooms, you know, essentially remotely being trained and becoming much more familiar with a piece of equipment through this virtual experience. So that then when they go into the real place with the actual device, they feel more familiar with it. And can be kind of onboarded much more quickly. So that application is about training and sort of and on-site assistance, right? It's like I'm doing maintenance on this thing and I can, you know, step through it with this guide, and I can sort of see what I'm supposed to do.
And I think they literally used this with COVID, right? With like ventilators or something to train people up to speed quickly on how to use
remote
them.
Ventilator sort of oversight, right? Being able to monitor those devices. Yeah.
But I mean, it's really cool. Like you can imagine like learning, you know, I've just seen it some videos, right? But it's fascinating. Like you can, like these people learning how to assemble a truck door, right? And the problem is you can't look inside the door anymore, but you know, you can have like virtually display everything that's inside and where the bolts are and where they should insert a piece of equipment. And so they could like learn instead of sitting in a classroom looking at pictures, they can be in front of the door and be guided, right? And it's pretty
cool. What the HoloLens will do for you in terms of the technology, like it's holographic projection in a sense, right? Like you're able to put 3D objects into your physical environment while wearing these glasses. And it's kind of like the Tony Stark thing, right? Like the Tony Stark engineering room where he has the 3D thing, right? Yeah. And he can do stuff to it and move it around.
And exactly. And but most importantly, to like actually anchor them to the physical world, right? Like it's in the right spot on the door, because it's like looking at the door and making sure that the bolt is actually in that spot. It's not just a freestanding display that could be anywhere, right?
Yeah. So I can essentially, you know, walk up to my station and work. And another cool thing about it was that it was hands-free, because we're kind of acknowledging that people are going to be holding equipment, you know, and doing the work. So, you know, you could essentially start your guide, look at the first, you know, slide that's this 2D, you know, floating panel. It will tell you what your first step is, and you could go and, you know, and it might show you like with an arrow, holographic arrow, over to the workbench, you know, and highlight the tool that you want to take. You take that tool, and then it had this really beautiful UI where you could just gaze at sort of the advance arrow. And if you gaze long enough, you get this visual feedback and a nice audio feedback that you progress to the next step without even, you know, you don't even need to use your hands. So you could navigate the whole thing with gaze. Yeah. Anyway, so that I think that is a very compelling use case, essentially enhancing your physical environment with the information you need right now to do your job. Another sort of application that was like a sister application to guides was called Remote Assist. And that's really about having somebody wear the HoloLens who's on site, who's, you know, observing a problem, say with a piece of equipment. And you can have a remote expert who's sitting, you know, at their computer who receives like a Teams call, and who then gets a visual feed from the HoloLens. And so they can then, that expert can walk the person through on site and guide them through how to fix the whatever it is that is a problem. And you can, you know, holographically annotate their view. So when you're looking at a complicated wiring board, you can circle, you know, it's this one. I want you to connect this one to this one. And that's holographically annotated. And so I think this has huge, you know, business value, right? You don't need to fly the expert, which is expensive and has time delays, you know, halfway across the world. You can do it sort of with this remote assistance. And I think, you know, the other thing is just the AI part. You know, obviously Microsoft is a player in sort of bringing language models into their applications. And so I think more recently, they brought sort of their co-pilot into this. So you could imagine how useful that would be. And I think real things are that the HoloLens has, you know, hand recognition. So you can be, you know, like pointing at something and say, you know, what's the history of this? You know, when was this last checked? Right. Or what's the torque on this?
Will I be able to go to the parties in Vancouver with a HoloLens and just feel like I'm there? just like hang out with my friends and you know, all this yeah, all the information just projected.
Well, I mean, with VR you sort of can, like, I mean, I just have like a, you know, whatever, right, it is, on that Oculus Meta Quest 2, the old one, right? But like, I play with, you know, people, you know, Russell and so on. We play mini golf, and it's a different feeling than playing on a computer screen, right? We're walking around the room, right, we're physically in relation to each other. You know, you're at that hole, I'm in your way. it's a very different feeling. So yeah, I mean, that part is sort of fascinating. Shared physical space is something we're very used to, and it does work, right? Now, that one's totally VR in that case, at least. But you know, it works for that. Even with the Quest 3 now, right? Like, it has great pass through. I mean, I don't think it has the HoloLens level of object, you know, detection and anchoring yet. But it can bring your couch into the VR and so on, right? And you can sit on your couch and it's there. So
yeah, I mean, just to be clear, like the HoloLens is you can like see through it. Like the visor of it is actually, you can look through it and see your world. And the Meta Quest technologies are using what Peter referred to as pass through. So there's outward facing cameras that are then projecting that camera feedback into your, you know, sort of locked in view. And the thing about it is it's remarkable how good it is. So, you know, I've tried the latest, you know, Meta Quest 3, and it's color, and you can feel pretty confident walking around. I mean, they encourage you to create barriers and stuff like that, but
well, the Meta Quest really 2, well, you have to. It's pretty have, bad yeah. pass-through. It's like grainy black and white.
Yeah, the older models, yeah. But, it, you know, you can just sort of project that forward, right? And that will just continue to get better. So I think you could certainly imagine a case where you're able to walk around anywhere in your house and see virtual content overlay.
So then you should, okay, so we could do the LARP sort of world of walking out there. If everybody had cameras, feed through kind of glasses, right, and they're not seeing the real world, we could decorate them with costumes and give them virtual objects. The problem is just each person's world, made-up world, can't really mesh with every other person's made-up world. Like, it's just a logical problem.
Well, you can imagine having one world that where you agree who everybody is, and that's doable minus the anchoring problems, right? You have to know where everybody is at any given time to put the costume in the right place, and that's hard-ish still. We're getting there, I think, right? I think the harder problem is if they don't share a world, right? Like, again, like, you know, how do you get to agreement as to if you're playing different games in the same space, right? Like, we just went to an amusement park near my hometown in Germany where you wear a VR headset while on a roller coaster. And so you can also imagine there is a roller coaster there where they don't do that, but where you are hanging off a roller coaster, it's called the fly coaster. So you can imagine wearing a VR headset there and flying through a city as you're actually physically.
Well, I also did something similar, and that is super scary being in any kind of real world complicated environment blinded by your VR. But I did the indoor skydiving. Do you guys have that out west? So it's this wind tunnel, right? And you get inside basically skydiving and you've got someone helping you. And you go in three times for like the basic package. And on the third one, they give you a VR, like a regular sort of VR headset. And they put you through like the squirrel suit flying guys that go like down the side of the mountain, like the most intense, crazy thing that, and you feel like you're doing it. You're like, right? And there's someone there holding you, thank God, right? So that you don't just... It was pretty intense. I was like, wow, I want more experiences like this. I want to feel like I'm on the moon. I want to feel like, you know, anything you can imagine.
Yeah. And so, I mean, at least I think, you know, some of that in the book is achieved because you're running around the real world, right? You're jumping off this thing and then leaping over this fence. And like, obviously you're not flying, but you're not just in your living room. Like, you are interacting with a real world that then has this virtual overlay such that it looks like something else, but you're getting that feedback, presumably.
Cool. So Peter, tell me your impressions from the beginning.
So to me, the best fleshed out part of the book is clearly the blockchain part. All of the stuff around that is clearly thought out to a greater degree than really any of the other stuff, even the VR stuff. You know, I mean, the VR is just sort of a plain projection of like, okay, we're doing it now, we'll do it, and then it doesn't solve any additional problems, I think. But the blockchain part is interesting because I think it does a good job actually of highlighting some of the problems, right? Like that are common problems, like the problem of oracles, or the problem of, you know, even if trust is on the chain, it has to go off chain at some point, right? You get data from a sensor, and if that data is fake, then, you know, doesn't matter how good your chain is, right? Like how trustworthy everything past that is wrong data, right? And so there, I feel like, I have some holes to poke into that I came up with Sydney, but they're far more detailed holes than I will have to poke into his AI stuff. Right. So for example, my big question about the blockchain, I did work, spend a year or two-ish working with blockchain stuff and people at DeviantArt. And the big question I was always left with is like, what work is the blockchain actually doing for us here, right? Because it's always imagined as this like amazing, trustless, you know, implementation of the future of banking or whatever you want it to do for you at the moment, right? When really all it is like a traceable, secure ledger where you can add transactions to the end, sort of. And there's smart contracts, which is the biggest misnomer in the world. It just means, you know, there's some functions that they can call to do stuff, right? And the problem with it always is there's all this promise as to what it could enable. And then you look at the applications and they're terrible, or they're nothing more than you could do without it. And it's supposed to add this layer of trust, but in the end, people are involved. And you still have to trust the people because of all the problems he raises in the book, Oracle problems and other problems of backdoors and, you know, all kinds of security measures, which you have to deal with in other spaces anywhere. Anyway, and so at some point, right, it's like, well, if you got to trust people, then is this blockchain doing any work for us whatsoever, right? And I feel the same way in the book here, and it doesn't reach that conclusion, but it's sort of like, is it necessary in the end, right? Is it actually helping anybody with anything here? Because like the solution in the end of like, oh, there's this one back door and there'll only ever be one, right? Like that's sort of the assumption here, that then magically transfers the power to the AIs, right? It's like, okay, like why, who is guaranteeing there isn't a second back door here, right? Like what, you just said this is all sort of insecure, right? Like, so why is this suddenly now guaranteed, right? Like it's not. It's clearly not, right? It's a technology with inputs and outputs, and it has to interact with the real world, and therefore will always be insecure at those boundaries.
Just to fill in a little bit, I read this a while ago. So what you're talking about is the sort of ability of an AI to just be a corporation, basically like an independent thing that runs around and does.
It's not even that yet. Like he gets to that, but if you remember, the whole book, sort of the resolution to the book hinges on there being this key, right, that the protagonist of the book happens to steal for her dad. And it's actually a key to a set of keys, right, that essentially let people change stuff on the blockchain that is used by all of these IoT devices, sensors and all the kinds of other stuff, you know, automatic pilots and whatever, right? And so the idea, as far as I understand it, is that like the company that discovers this is essentially selling these keys to other people that want to hide their bad environmental record or whatever, right? And for some reason, there's only one master key, and they sort of decide this, you know, the key to these keys is the master key, and they hide it in this like physically disconnected computer. Hard drive that she then goes and steals, right? And now she has the key to these other keys that enable this whole scheme, right? All of this based on some exploit that was discovered, where the whole book assumes that there's only one of this type, right? And then also it relies on you know, a great majority of the devices actually still using this, right? And he sort of admits to that, right? It's like, okay, it's an unpatched vulnerability, sort of, right? And they haven't patched it, right? Yeah, but even with all of that, right, from a just super high level, again, I always have this question of like, what really, if these are all, yeah, the holes you can poke into blockchain stuff, what is it really doing, right? Is it doing anything in this? Anyway, that's a very big question, and I've asked that before, and obviously there are people who vehemently disagree with me on this all over the place, because the blockchain is a big thing. But in all the years of trying to use it for anything, we really just were like, and then you look in detail, right? And a lot of the places that pretend they're, mm-hmm, using the blockchain, they're not, right? Like OpenSea, right? It's like a big marketplace for NFTs, right? Like, because it's expensive to use the blockchain, they only use the blockchain at the very last moment, right? Until then, you have to trust them that they're doing the right thing, because it's all on their computers, right? Like, so this notion of trustlessness is just totally bogus, if you ask me, at least in any real world implementation I've seen.
You guys heard the episode with Cory Doctorow, but he tells the story of, like, I think it was the founders of Ethereum or something made some mistake. There was some vulnerability and they had like $1 billion stolen from them. And they're like, well, just this once, we're actually going to go back and change that.
Yeah, just this once.
Like, exactly. Well, okay.
Yeah. It's I get the fascination with the tech, but I have yet to see an application that I actually believe in that it's solving anything. Okay, but that said, again, I want to repeat that I do think technologically there's a lot more, at least you did there, in terms of weaving that into the story and thinking about it, the whole self-sovereignty thing and so on, and trying to explain that, mm-hmm, in a story. There's a lot of detail, right? And correct, right? Like fine. And it's interesting, and it's certainly thought-provoking, right? It's like, yeah, like he's highlighting all these things that not everybody that doesn't work with blockchain is thinking about, right? Like, well, how do we trust the things before, mm-hmm, they go on the blockchain or when they come off or whatever? Now to AI, right? So, okay, so, but I mean, maybe again, to go very high level, right? So in some sense, this whole book to me is about, I guess I want to say, incentive alignment. Right. So the whole VR and blockchain supporting VR and transactions and self-sovereignty and everything is sort of about, so I don't know, there's sort of a couple of big ways in which you can get people to try to do the right thing, I feel, right? There is like the sort of fully libertarian or whatever you want to call it view of like, you shouldn't try to get people to do anything they don't already want to do, right? Like, they're their own people. There shouldn't be government, right? They know best. And you have to somehow hope that we evolve to make the right decisions, right? On average. I think that's clearly not the case. we're terrible at this individually. And it makes evolutionary sense that we're terrible at it, I think. We did not grow up in a global society or with massive problems that can only be solved over huge timescales and by trusting very, you know, indirect data. Fine, right? So that's one view, I think. Another view is like sort of strong government, right? There's like some smaller group of people, scientists, politicians, whatever, that decide what's the right thing to do. And they somehow incentivize the population to do this, right? And it's like, well, you can make laws, you can put out ads, right? Get vaccinated against COVID, right? You can give prices for getting vaccinated against COVID, right? Try to figure out, it's the right thing to get vaccinated against COVID. So you have to make that decision, right? So that's sort of your first job. And then the second job is to convince everybody else that, right, they should actually follow your advice, right? That's sort of the strong government version, right? Or you can imprison them if they do the wrong thing or whatever, right? And so where I feel the book is trying to go is somewhere in between those two, right? It's sort of this distributed government, I don't know, this distributed incentive alignment, right? Where it's not like you just make your own decisions. And it's not there's some indirect power that has very crude methods of convincing people, but it's this direct in the world, like, if we can just use these apples, you know, grab these apples and put them over there, that's a good thing to do. Nobody wants to do it. Well, let's put it in a game and they'll do it because it's in a game, right? And they get some game reward for it. Right. And that's totally compelling as an incentive alignment thing. Like, we do this on DeviantArt all the time, right? It's like, we want people to do some action more. Well, we somehow try to align the incentives, right, that people comment more, right? But it's this like incentive alignment in the world, automatic incentive alignment, right? And that's cool. Don't get me wrong. I think that idea is really cool. It's like you know, putting it into the real world, which I obviously don't do, right? And saying like, here, I can show you in this game world the things you should be doing, right? You should be moving these things over there and delivering this and building a shop over here, right? Helping to build a shop because that shop is needed. Cool, cool idea, right? The big problem I have is I don't know where the decisions come from as to what we're actually trying to get people to do. I feel that's completely underexplained, right? It's like, so who's making these decisions? The LARP rights themselves? These random people who somehow get included in a society, like somebody approaches her at some point and then she's a LARP right, and now she gets to decide what the right thing to do is, so she now has like the best
And also, like, how do the incentives not conflict,
right? And then the next step is absolutely is like, yeah, this is a highly complicated problem, right? Like, we haven't solved it as a society, certainly, what the right thing to do is in every like local case, and we've done many wrong things. And then, yeah, now, okay, there's trade-offs here. Let's be clear, right? Like, if you're saying, like, I'm taking this stuff away from here because we could use it better over there. Well, maybe somebody wants it over there, right? Or maybe you're taking the resource away. Or I don't know, right? Like, there's obvious conflict here. He alludes to that somewhere where, like, some of the towns are working out something. But it's, like, super under the radar in the whole book, right?
And also, there's an impression that they're all quite positive, right? You know, the outcome is that we've rehabilitated this neighborhood, but again, like, who's deciding and who's not to, you know, somebody could very easily have a malicious intent.
What if an evil leopard shows up?
Maybe the malicious intent is masked with something that appears to be, you know, of a different purpose. I don't know. It all sounds very positive, and I'm doubtful, like, if that's a free for all. I don't think it would end up that way. Yet.
For me, it goes back right to libertarianism, only more dangerous. Right? It's like, now you're giving people with local bad ideas the power to make other people do what their bad idea is. Right? Like, that sounds extremely dangerous to me.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just, maybe there's some, you know, and then again, so, and then, okay, so that's my complaint about that whole thing. And then he expands that to say, okay, that works for like being more efficient in resource consumption and, you know, rebuilding stuff and so on. But it doesn't solve environmental problems, right? Because now this is just human beings looking out for themselves. And nobody's representing all the other stuff that we're destroying. Right. And so then the big idea essentially is, okay, well, let's represent the other stuff that we're destroying in this incentive system, right? With its own ability to maybe write games. I don't actually know how exactly this turns out in the end, but something like that, right?
Which I think I would just interject, I think is a cool idea, right? Like, I like the idea of very much of that you somehow.
Again, I have nothing against the incentive system, and I love the expansion to, you know, hey, like, let's have inanimate objects or animate objects that aren't human or whatever represent themselves in this incentive system. Totally fine with it, right? What I hate is then the, like, oh, and we're going to do this by some wise woman in the woods AI system who invented this to solve all of these problems that I just mentioned, all these trade-off problems and what the right thing to actually do is for the environment and everything on a highly detailed level. She just sat in her cabin in the woods and wrote this AI that does this all magically, apparently by telling the thing what it is. Right. I have no idea what that means. And it is just... extremely underdeveloped. I'm sorry. But like, wow, there was a lot you could have done here to A, think about the issue of like, how do you come up with the right thing to do? And then B, talk a little bit about AI as to what are we talking about here, right? Like, right. I have no idea what that means.
Yeah, how it automatically results in balance
Yeah, and then it just resolves in perfect balance, right? It's like, why wouldn't this AI wipe out humanity as its first step? That seems like the right thing to do if you want to save the environment. I don't understand what the incentive for AI is to not do that. Is there some, there's some vague, like, oh, but human beings are part of it. Like, I mean, yeah, bullshit. Like, I mean, no, I mean, you can get rid of them and the environment will do just fine. I don't believe it, right? So I found that really, really, really weak. It's like sort of AI out of the box somehow solves everything. And, you know, and you might say, like, oh, but AI has made so much progress even since this book was written, right? Don't we have the tech now? Well, no, we don't. Like, we really, really don't. What we have are highly sophisticated systems that predict which word to say next.
Yeah.
That's all they do. Let's be clear here, right? That we cannot control in a good way at all. I just went to a, you know, one of the bigger AI conferences, and there's so many papers about, like, how do we control large language models, essentially, and nobody knows how to, because all they are is these statistical next word prediction machines. And yes, you can prompt them by saying, like, you are, you know, in an ecosystem that includes this river, and it'll produce words that sound like it's an ecosystem that includes this river, and they may be bullshit, right? Like, there's no planning in these systems, no planning whatsoever. And it's a big problem. And we don't know how to learn how to plan.
Yeah.
It's just wide open problem, right? Like, none of this exists. Or how to, like, come up with these utility functions for, like, oh yeah, you know, like, human beings shouldn't, like, you know, put stuff in this river because that's bad. But, you know, why wouldn't they? Well, you know, I don't know what we're even talking about there, right? Like, how are we making those decisions? Well, that's why we have a whole science to figure out what even the right thing to do is. And now an AI is doing this? Yeah, I just don't know how that leap happens. So that I found very disappointing, right? Like, after all of the cool stuff in terms of, like, yep, totally, let's incentivize in the real world with, you know, VR and AI, I get it, right? But then to be, like, not even mention that there's a problem as to, like, what are we incentivizing people to do?
Right.
Just found
fair.
Found very
fair. Wow. All right. I want to ask you both, since, you know, you really do know these fields, you know where they've been, you know where they are. And I would love to get it, you know, you to say something about what do you think is the future? Like, what, maybe in our lifetimes, or maybe in our kids, or your kids' lifetimes, my kids, right? Like, what will exist in terms of artificial intelligence that will work? And that isn't, like, I mean, I think it's really interesting that what you said about large language models. I mean, it makes me think they're artificial unintelligence, right? They're actually almost actively unintelligent, right? Like, it's the opposite of what you want. It's just a mimic, you know, some talking head. There's no intelligence there. So,
I mean, that's, yeah.
So will there be, how do we get there? Is it just going to be a different, completely different approach to create real AI? I guess they call it, what is it? General AI?
I think, yeah, I mean, that's a very, very hard and often discussed question. Like, is, you know, like there are people in my group that I run at DeviantArt who sort of believe that it's just stepping stones past this, right? That it's like, we just need to push this further, right? Because we're getting we're clearly getting a level of complexity out of this and of complexity of behavior out of this that we've never gotten before. That is so good that, like, it sort of passes a bunch of Turing tests in some sense, you know, that is fooling people into thinking they're conscious and all kinds of stuff. So the problem with it really is, like I said, that it is this purely statistical model that is trying to predict sort of the future, right? Not knowing where it's going. And even, like I said, even during my PhD, we sort of had these ideas of, like, hey, isn't planning and plan recognition really important for what kids do? Some people think that interacting with the physical world is really important. You need to be able to push something to really get what it is. I'm not even saying that anymore, but I do feel that there are clear limits to them right now, right? Like, yeah, we can make them even bigger, and maybe they'll, you know, but they won't play chess. It's funny, right? Because chess is, like, one of the oldest solved problems of AI, and now we're building these very sophisticated models that can't plan, right? And they can do some amazing stuff because we're making them bigger and bigger, and they're sort of memorizing more and more stuff. And so it looks like we can push it, but I'm not convinced that we can. Like they have like no actual symbolic reasoning, no planning, no nothing. And that's really, and it's honestly been an AI problem for decades now, is like combining machine learning from scratch, like these models do, right? Feeding massive amounts of data with some sort of symbolic reasoning and planning to do actual math, you know, to like, they can imitate some math by now, right? But like, again, you can do a lot with next action, next word prediction if you've absorbed enough data, right? But, and so then I guess the real question becomes, right, are we just doing that? And I don't think we are, right? Like, I think we are, we do plan, right? We do more than these models do. Do I think that will be solved in my lifetime? I mean, I like to think so. It's gotten so much attention now. There's people actively working on this. I think so. I absolutely think so. But just in terms of maybe shorter term horizon, I do think the generative AI part is going to change the world pretty quickly. I mean, it is changing it every month, and it's getting better every month. And I do think, you know, that within a short period of time, you know, maybe things like Netflix and everything will not need to pay content creators anymore. Because if you want a new episode of a TV show that you like, you can just ask for it and the AI will make it for you. Now, there's huge ethical problems with this, obviously, as is very evident from recent strikes and discussions and everything. And we need to solve those, right? Like just, I mean, but honestly, that's like with any new tech that comes along that threatens people's jobs, that doesn't mean that we can't have the tech, right? It means that there are ethical issues to be solved here. And this tech is a little bit different. I mean, maybe vastly different, because it is directly using some of the work of the people that it's stealing the jobs from to, you know, understand what it is that it's supposed to do. So that's even worse than saying like, you know, oh, well, we invented the electric light bulb and we put all the candle makers out of work because, well, they didn't probably directly contribute to inventing the electric light bulb or running it. But still, I think that's, you know, and again, like even I think about this every day because, you know, we're somewhere in between. We have our platform, I mean, in my day job, I help run a platform for real artists traditionally, right, that paint and take pictures and make models and whatever, run fractal algorithms, right, which is also computer-based and whatever, you know. But now we're also in this where suddenly a large percentage of our submissions are AI generated. We have our own AI generator, right? And it's completely correct to point out that that's problematic in many ways. But at the same time, you know, I do think it's art in some way. And I'm not to say that this is not art. And there's opens up massive amounts of possibilities for all sorts of people that maybe even weren't artists before, that maybe were artists before and have new ways of using AI now, right? It's huge. And when you look at where it's being used, right? Like I went to a talk the other day where how this is being used to make self-driving cars better, right? Because you can just generate all of these scenes that these cars have never seen and will never see because they're so rare, right? Hey, there's this elephant walking across the road, right? Yeah, it does happen, but it happens, you know, rarely. But then all of these weird things happen rarely enough in one instance that some of that will happen while you're driving. And generative AI can help with that, right? Like it can generate all of these crazy things that somebody will see on the road somewhere in the world. And the woman who gave the talk was really fun. She put up a slide like that in the very beginning, right? And was like, you know, there was like a fully golden, shiny Mercedes that you could like see your own reflection in, right? Like very hard to detect for as a normal car. There was like a house on a highway, you know, being pulled by a truck. Looks just like a house on the road, right? There was like an elephant, I think, and like something jumping out of the bush. And she's like, you know, you think these are rare, but three of those I took myself, right? Like this stuff happens, right? So I think for all that kind of stuff, right, like improving models and generating stuff and so on, it's an amazing time that we're living in, right? And you see that everywhere, right? Models are partially getting better because we now have models that can produce realistic data for us that we can train the models on, right? And that feedback cycle is just making things take off at breakneck pace, right? And that's just really exciting, I think. But like I said, there are real challenges left that we're nowhere near solving and that not enough people are even working on. So
cool. How about you, Sydney? Where do you see VR and mixed reality and all of that in your kid's lifetime or yours?
Yeah. Well, I think I'd probably fall into the camp of people who, you know, believe that technology is only going to get better. And certainly lots of tech companies are betting on that and scrambling to imagine what it's going to look like. You know, the hardware we have today is certainly not there yet. At least, you know, there's a way to go to have that be a computer on everybody's face. But it's imaginable that will just iteratively improve with time. So, you know, would it take over? Would it be the death of the 2D display? Like would that all go away? I'm doubtful. I don't think things are that black and white. You can even, you know, take the example of mobile devices and, you know, probably a lot of people can do most of their daily tasks on their mobile device. They perhaps don't need a keyboard and a mouse and a computer, but for a lot of work you do. And it's, even in the book, it's quite interesting. He makes reference to her. She had to kind of trash her desktop computer and her leaving her apartment. And, you know, these things still exist. And I very much think that is true. We will have some hybrid, you know, environment where there's a whole spectrum of devices for different purposes. But, you know, if you then imagine having glasses and everybody else having glasses, it's like, what would you do with them? How would that change? You know, I'm not really one who makes predictions and thinks about this stuff all day, but I think you could, you know, safely make some projections off of what we've already seen with mobile devices. You know, what does a phone do for you? Well, certainly access to information, you know, while you're out in the world, that's a huge, huge factor. You know, maps, you know, looking up things. So just project that into your glasses. Right now, I don't have to fumble with the phone. And I think coupled with a conversational agent, right? If I can now look at a plant and be like, what is that? You know, what is that plant? And, you know, record it. And I think that sort of access to information in the moment where you need it, I could really see that becoming incredibly useful and everywhere. And really it's just an extension of what we have with most of our phones.
To point out that one of the things I did like about visualization in the book wasn't the, like, you know, spaghetti graph of relations, but the more of the mapping stuff, where you're walking through a town and you might be able to see things like pollution levels, noise levels, you know, whatever your current filter you're interested mm-hmm. in, right? It's like, where are the other Pokemon Go players, right? Like, where are my friends? Where are, you know, like all of that kind of stuff. Like, you know, where are the crowds? Like all of this information that you're interested in, that could alert you, that could give you a better sense. And there, I think education could actually work, right? Where it's like, you know, oh, like here's where your power comes from in the mm-hmm. city, right? Like, all of that kind of stuff that you could visualize that you just hide in everyday stuff, but that is actually super interesting, right? Where does your water go? Where does your water come from, right? Like all this stuff, if you could suddenly, it's available data, right? If you could see that in the city anchored to the actual thing, I would walk around and look at all of that and be totally.
Yeah, you certainly have a phone app today that was like that. I mean, yeah,
exactly. But it's awkward, right? Yeah. You're like, you know, oh, okay, you might pull it out once or mm-hmm. twice and so on, right? But I don't know, to be able to do that smoothly, like I think there's a huge amount of potential applications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That, right? I guess I think the, you know, the other thing that you think about like mobile devices doing is, I think the social aspect and also maybe content sharing, right? You know, capturing your life, sharing aspects of your life with your social, you know, network, the ability to connect with people, the ability to see people. So just project that forward, right? Maybe now having somebody, you know, represented in my view. And I think we have early versions of all of this stuff, right? Even Peter's example of playing like a virtual reality golf game, right? You can see your friends in this virtual space, kind of in an avatar view. If you just sort of imagine that getting better and better, I could imagine glasses like this just helping people be more connected. And
there I do feel, you know, I'm not a, maybe I'm a more of a believer in government than he is, right? But you do see examples of stuff like, you know, sharing who needs their sidewalk clean because they're not able to shovel the snow on their sidewalk, right? You could imagine that for a lot of stuff in the city, right? And right now you can sort of do it with a phone app and so on. But you could imagine that kind of incentive alignment that being able to access the information for the people who want to do it, maybe even without it being a game, could be really cool, right? If you want to go and help clean up the beach or you know, help the city in some way, right? You could imagine that seeing that in the city would be way more accessible than, you know, trying to find it on a phone app and then navigating there with Google Maps or something like that, right?
Yeah, so, you could activate things like that and then see them as you walk.
Or you could be alerted to them if you're interested in them, right? As you're walking by it, you're like, you know, oh, look, right? Like, here's something I can help with, right? Like, and the delivery example that I think he gave in the interview too is also an interesting one, right? Where it's like, but not the one he gives with the blockchain, but more sort of the opportunistic delivery, right? It's like sort of more like the Uber kind of, you know, maybe not getting paid for it even, right? But it's like just something that becomes more possible, I feel, than with if you can actually mark up the real world rather than having to have it on your phone, right? Like, I think there's a lot of potential there.
Right. Cool. Wow. Well, thanks, guys. This is exactly what I wanted. Thanks. I mean, you guys are very insightful and totally great to talk to about these things.
No, it was fun.
Thanks so much, Marty. Thanks for having us on the show.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for coming.
Yeah. Thank you.
Nice to see you.
Likewise.
Good to see you, Marty.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks, Sydney. And thanks, everyone, for listening. I love it when we can make contact between the science in the fiction and the science in the real world. And I think we've done that quite admirably on this topic. So that's it for now on artificial intelligence and virtual reality. And next up, we are returning to the theme of planetary protection, along the same lines as our episodes 19 and 20 about bringing back samples from the OSIRIS-REx mission, except now we'll be talking about the promise and peril of discovering life on Mars and bringing it back to Earth. We'll be talking to science fiction author Edward M. Lerner about his book, Life and Death on Mars. Next time on The Science and the Fiction.